Yongdan stopped abruptly, which caused everybody, including myself, to start up. Then he divided the grains that had been used for the performance of the rite into two parts, putting one half aside in a corner of his handkerchief, and leaving THD remaining part in the paper which was folded in a peculiar and complicated way. "Here, take it," he ordered the Nepo, "and listen, you will open that paper tomorrow at sunset, and throw the grain it contains toward the sky in the four directions. I myself will at the same time recite the gags, spells, needed to make an abundant fall of snow. Now, if you open the paper before sunset, before I have uttered the gags, the deities, not being propitiated in the proper way, null feel irritated and revenge themselves upon you all. So be careful." The man promised to follow his A.A. the orders he had received, and at last the thought arose in his mind that he had perhaps exacted from the Lama more than the value of the meager hospitality he had shown us. So he told his wife to fetch a piece of meat that Lyra might carry as provision on the road. The woman brought a quite excellent piece, but her husband snatched it out of her hand before she had time to present it to the Lama, hung it up again, and carefully chose a skinny bit which he gave with the utmost gravity to my companion. We were hard put to it not to laugh aloud, so much had we enjoyed the fun. "Cannot," declared Yongdan, who is perfectly conversant with the religious monastic rules, "thank you for a gift of meat, which is an impure thing, the result of the great sin of killing. It would be as if I rejoiced at the slaughter of that animal, because I have a pie of its flesh to eat, but give me some sampo and I will bless your home." The words of the Lama were most edifying and strictly orthodox, but they had still another quality, in that they were to provide us with some barley flour, which, however small in quantity, would prove very useful. A big bowl heaped high with sampo was placed before him. Yongdan threw a few pinches of it in various directions, called health and prosperity on the host, his family, and his belongings. And before the Nepo had time to take back the flour, which he had only lent for ritualistic purposes, my son poured the contents of the bowl into our bag, which I had promptly extended toward him, kneeling in a most devout attitude. We now hoped that the old miser, who looked rather astonished at the sight of his empty bowl, would allow the Lama to rest. We were anxious to sleep a few hours before starting on a new tiring march whose end we could not foresee. The pass might be blocked, or other obstacles might arise on our way. Who could ever tell? As for Dokpaza, we felt safe. I had very well understood the cunning of Yongdan, who wished to prevent any of the cowmen Froni following us. The next morning the stony of the grain would spread, and Vela One would feel far too interested in its uselessness to attempt anything that could hinder the magic work which was to bring the desired snow. Then, when the grain had been thrown toward the sky, the Dokpas would wait for the result for at least another full day. We should be far away by the time, amongst other people, at least, so we believed, but events were to take a very different turn. Two women arranged the couch of the Nepo for the night. I cannot say the bed, for Tibetans, as well as a large number of Asiatics, including Japanese, have no bed. Rich Tibetans sleep on thick cushions covered with lined tapestry, poor ones on the bare floor or ground. Between these two extremes there exist countless degrees of thickness and beauty in the cushions, until one comes to a single piece of ragged sackcloth or of greasy sheepskin, but in any case, the blankets, or whatever takes their place, are put aside during the day and brought out when they are needed for the night. When all was ready, the old Dokpa took off his robe, keeping on his trousers, according to the general custom of Tibet, where women as well as men sleep with the upper part of the body naked. Then he slipped between the sheepskins which were spread at the best and warmest place near the hearth. A bucket was placed in the middle of the room to spare to the people of the house the trouble of going out at night. I had never seen such a thing elsewhere. Village people, as a rule, have regular closets, partly for cleanliness' sake, but especially to accumulate manure for the field, that supplied by the cows, sheep, and goats being reserved as fuel. Dokpas in the solitude, who have large spaces before them and no agriculture whatever, do not feel the need of special accommodation and as a rule retire outside their tents at night as well as in daytime. Most of the men and women had not waited for the master to lie down. Young married couples rolled themselves in a large blanket with their children between them, elder people or bachelors rested alone, and the youngsters heaped themselves together like so many puppies, laughing and fighting for their share of the covering rags, till sleep silenced them. Chapter 5. How many hours have I slept? Cannot guess. I felt as if I had shut my eyes only a few minutes before. It is time to start, repeats the man whose voice has awakened me. He throws a few branches amongst the smoldering embers, the flame illumines the sleepers, some of whom grumble and roll up more tidy in their blankets. We are quickly ready. Dressing consists merely of tying our belts and our garters, for our loads have not been opened. We are off in no time. Kale Febalama, says the Nepo from between his sheepskin covering as we pass the door. The moon, screened by a high peak, sheds but a dim light upon the valley. The wind blows hard. I feel exceedingly cold and my fingers freeze. Even wrapped as they are in the long sleeves of my thick dress, I have difficulty in gripping my staff. The shallow river which was flowing the day before at the place we crossed it is here covered with thick ice. On the opposite bank the narrow trail winds between thickets. It branches several times, and other tracks cross it. We should very likely have wasted a good deal of time in that labyrinth, had we not been guided. I decline, as does Yongdan, the invitation to ride. It is too dreadfully cold. I prefer to keep on walking until the sun rises. The landscape, as much as I can see of it, is very different from that which extends between Tasitsi and the summit of the Deola. The latter was truly majestic, whereas the narrow valley which we now follow breathes occult hostility and treachery. After a few hours' walk, a pale green dawn breaks and rather adds to the uncomfortable impression produced by the landscape. There is but little snow on the track we are following, but enormous quantites are heaped in the gorges which score its sides. The sun rises shyly amidst the clouds. We cross small pastures covered with wet grass, wintry and yellowish. I ride for a while, but soon get off and linger behind, leaving the horse to Yongdan. The Dokpa who walks at his PRTH annoys me with his uninterrupted twaddle. I like silence when wandering across the hills. So many voices may be heard by trained ears and an attentive mind. A little later, snow begins to appear on the path and grows deeper as we continue. A gigantic white mound marks the beginning, says our guide, of a summer track leading to another pass. Seeing it, I understand that I must give up all idea of roaming about on the range, as I should have liked to do. Explorations in those regions ought to take place during the very short period between the time when the mud caused by the melting of the snow and the summer rains is somewhat dried, and that of the first important snowfall, an interval of scarcely 6 weeks. That year, owing to that scarcity of snow which alarms the Dokpas, the Ainila is easily practicable. We reach Italatsa before noon. Our guide has laid down the lama's load, which he had carried until then. He is about to leave us and take his horse back to the camp. Although our disguise and our care for our safety did not allow us to be over generous, I had always meant to give a little present to the good man. Yongdan's sermon on the merits inherent in the services rendered gratis to Lama pilgrims was aimed only at convincing the doctors of our poverty. The night before, when all had been asleep, I whispered in my young companion's ear what he was to do. And now he obeys my instructions. Slowly he produces 2 coins from his purse and, wrapped in a piece of paper, a pinch of dried cypress leaves, this money, he declares, solemnly, is all that I have got. I have received it from the Ponpo of Tasitsi, for the welfare of whom I read the sacred scripture at the Zong. You have helped us both, my mother and me. I therefore give it to you as well as that Sangha which comes from the far distant holy place of pilgrimage, called Kakapo. Though the price we give for the hiring of a horse with its driver is small, money is so rare amongst Dokpas that the man cannot but be satisfied. We are confident, also, that he will hide the silver and keep silent about it, lest someone should rob him of it. Thus do we mingle prudence and righteousness. Yongden adds some words meant to impress the man and his friends, to whom he will doubtless repeat them, and to let them know that we are not devoid of protection in the country we are entering. This detail may easily influence the Dokpas and prevent them from following us. Take the money, elder brother, insists the Lama. We have arrived on the territory of the Pojialpo, king. His Anchos, chaplain, is an old friend of mine. We both belong to the Sero Monastery at Lhasa, so, if I am in need, he will ask the king to help me. Of course he will, Kusho, sir, agrees the man, in a respectful tone which shows how much the poor travelers have progressed in his esteem. But I prefer to take the Sang alone. It is most precious. As for the money, if I accepted it I would lose the merit of having served a Lama. No, I shall not take it. I like better to keep the merit. It is useful for the next life as well as for this one. Please give me your blessing, Kusho. I must make haste now. Kalphib. Lama. Kalphib, mother. With that he was gone, happy with the dust of a few dry leaves and the belief that he had sown a few seeds of future felicity in this world or in another one. The poor thing. My hearty good wishes followed him. We stood near the Lhasa. We had not shouted the habitual Alhajala as Tibetan custom requests. We had nothing of the joyful excitement which makes one enthusiastically salute the conquest of the summit at the end of an exhausting climb. Accustomed to long tramps, that short ride had been a real luxury to us. For the first time since we had left China, we had reached a pass without fatigue, and perhaps it was that which prevented us from being cheerful. Anyhow, it was neither the time nor the place to tarry and ponder over psychological problems. The shout was rather listless. It will snow, said Yongden, who looked unusually grave. I suspect it since the sun has risen in such a melancholy way, I replied. But will it snow today? Could Anepo have thrown, before the appointed hour, the grain you gave him yesterday? The joke found no echo in the Lama. Let us be quick, he said. I did not like to see him in such a gloomy mood, so I continued. Do you remember that Nagspa Lama of the Kokan or who could, so the cowman said, make the snow and rain and hail fall or stop at his will? Me has taught me some of his gags. Let us bet on the result. You have called the snow. I will try to prevent it. The young man did not even smile. The poor fellows need snow for their pastures, he said. Let them have it, and he began to stride down the steep white slope. His strange attitude impressed me. Why was he so greatly concerned about snow? We had seen much of it in previous journeys. It was not a thing to frighten us, especially as we were so near the villages. Perhaps he felt unwell. I hastened to join the Lama, who was already far below. In spite of my efforts, the distance between him and me increased rapidly, which annoyed me. I tried to run straighter, avoiding the loss of time caused by long windings. Then, I suppose some invisible and compassionate little mountain fairy, seeing my trouble and wishing to do me a gracious service, pulled me by the foot. In the tenth part of a second I fell and slid just as in a toboggan race, yet with the noteworthy difference that I was myself the toboggan and its driver, all in one. I had happily succeeded in grasping my staff low enough to use it to steer. In such wise, dispensing with any tacking, I passed Yongden with the speed of an express train and pulled up far ahead of him. He hurried as quickly as he could and joined me as I shook off the snow that covered my dress and my load. Satisfied with my answer that I had not hurt myself, he declared that my performance looked quite pretty and had spared me a good deal of exertion. It had another result, which I appreciated still more, for Yongden had recovered his good-humored laugh. What vague premonition had for a moment thrown a gloom over the cheerful mind of my young companion? I did not venture to offer any explanation. But truly we were approaching rather trying circumstances. Judging from the scenery, I could guess that the country toward which we proceeded was entirely different from the Upper Salween Basin in its physical aspects. The air was charged with moisture, the ground wet, even slightly marshy, in some places. Snow had already fallen in quantities and the doctors of the region had no reason to feel anxious for the growth of the grass, as did those living on the opposite side of the mountain range. Soon we entered the zone of trees and followed the shore of the river springing at the foot of the Anila. It led us to large pasture lands which occupied the area at the intersection of three valleys. We had walked down through one of them, another opened just opposite, beyond the pastures, and a stream, larger than that coming from the Aini Pass, issued from it. The third received the united waters of the two rivers which would, far away, flow into the Utsangpo, Brahmaputra, and bring the melted snows of the mighty range I had crossed into the Indian Ocean. I had now been able to discover one of the springs of the River Po, whose upper course is unknown to geographers. The second interested me greatly. It originated, it seemed, in the vicinity of the pass which the Dokpas had named Yontsongland, which was blocked for the present. That much to be regretted circumstance left me no hope of climbing it to inspect the range on that side. But I wished at least to follow the river up as high as I could, and to gather whatever observations I might be able to make in my humble way. I was far from suspecting that this bit of rough scouting, such as I had so often done in Tibet, was to lead me into a short but rather exciting adventure which turned out all right, but could have ended otherwise. Briefly, I explained my intention to Yongdan. Still more laconic, he answered curtly, "It will snow, and we have no food." These were words worthy of some reflection. The snow? I did not fear it. As for the food, I opened the bags, inspected their contents with the lama, and we agreed that there remained a sufficient quantity for 3 meals. 3 meals meant 3 days, for we had not come to these Thiban wilds to indulge in gastronomy. Moreover, I did not intend to linger in the upper valleys. A mere glance would satisfy my curiosity and enable me to supply a few general facts to those interested in the Virgin River. Forward. After sunset the snow began to fall, lightly at first, and just a few butterflies whirling among the black trees. Then it gradually became more and more dense, one of those slow snowfalls, whose flakes descend from some inexhaustible heavenly store, shrouding the mighty peaks and burying the valleys. "Let us pitch the tent," I said. "We will light a fire inside it and have tea. We really needed some refreshment. Since the evening soup of the day before, eaten at the Dokpaza camp, we had taken no food. Dry wood was scarce. To cut and collect some while the snow fell kept us busy for a long time. Nevertheless we gathered enough small branches to boil the tea. Our frugal meal having been hastily eaten, we threw the remaining embers outside, for the heat melted the snow on the thin cloth and water dripped freely on us. It also became evident that our pilgrim staffs, which were used as tent poles, could not bear the weight of the snow for long. Since we could not run the risk of breaking them, we established, with the cloth only, a kind of sloping shelter fixed with a few stones on an adjacent rock. We then lay down beneath it, and as it was not very cold we soon fell asleep. A sensation of painful oppression awakened me. I lifted my head, and immediately knocked it against our roof. Overloaded with snow, it had sagged and we were being buried. There was, for the time being, nothing tragic about the matter. Anyhow, WC had better be quick and get out while it was still easy. I pushed Yongdan, who was asleep. He needed no explanation to understand the situation, which was plain enough. I only said, "Let us turn slowly and then get up together, pushing the cloth with our backs. Ready? Gee up." We were out of our grave, and none the better for it. Snow fell and we had no hope of fixing another shelter, for we would have been buried again before long. No rest being possible, it was better to walk and keep warm. We tramped the remainder of the night and all the next morning without making much progress. The soft snow made walking difficult. Then, when we had reached a higher level, we began to slip on the miniature glaciers formed by previous snowfalls, that had repeatedly melted and frozen again and which were now treacherously hidden under a thick new layer. We established ourselves on its dry ground. Our tent, hung like a curtain to some roots above our heads, added to the protection afforded by the cave. No fuel was available, but we ate a little tsampa and quenched our thirst with snow which we melted in our mouths. Then, overtired, after two nights spent nearly without rest, we slept soundly till the morrow at dawn. When we awakened, the snow was still falling. We could see that it had not ceased the whole night, for it was heaped much higher in front of our prehistoric refuge and formed a wall that had kept us warm during the night. I decided to leave our bags in the sarfug and to attempt a reconnaissance higher up. We should walk the more easily, carrying only our mountain staffs. As we were compelled to retrace our steps to reach the Po villages, we would pick up our baggage again on our way down. As for thieves, they were not much to be feared in that deserted land, on the road to a blocked pass. We started. Snow continued to fall in the same slow, inexorable, unavoidable way, as it had done for more than 40 hours. We found it forming impassable barriers at some points where it had accumulated on old layers already thick. It was impossible to follow any regular direction. With great exertion I reached a ridge from where, through the moving curtain of the white soft flakes, I faintly discerned summits which looked like sloping, undulated tablelands. But who knows if the snow had not leveled the ground and changed their aspect. It is a common thing, well known to all alpinists, that mountains which assume rounded lines in their wintry garb show, in the summer, sharp spurs and rocky peaks like needles. I went down with still greater difficulty than I had experienced in climbing up, and endeavored to reach another spot from which I hoped to ascertain if a stream joining the main river issued from what appeared to be a small gorge. I was pushing forward when I heard a cry behind me. Yongdana, while looking for a short cut, had slipped and fallen into a ravine. This was not very deep, yet, shut between nearly vertical banks, its access was anything but easy. When, after a few minutes, I reached my poor companion, he looked pitiable enough, lying in his ragged llama dress on the white snow stained with drops of blood. "Nothing, nothing serious at all," he said, answering my questions. "T must have knocked my head against a rock when rolling down. The skin is a little cut, but there is nothing more. Do not be afraid. The shock only made me giddy." Then he moved to get up, uttered a moan, whilst he became pale, shut his eyes, and whispered, "Oh, my foot." He tried a second time to stand, but without success. "I cannot," he said, the pain bringing tears to his eyes. "I cannot stand." I felt terrified. Had he broken his leg? What should we do in that case, alone in the wilderness, without food and the snow growing higher hour after hour? I immediately took off his boot and examined his foot. Happily, the bones were unbroken. He had merely sprained his ankle and somewhat bruised his knee. The accident in itself did not endanger his life or his general health. At least, it would not have done so in any inhabited place, but out here. He understood as well as I did the gravity of our situation and again endeavored to rise. With my help he succeeded and remained up one foot, leaning on his staff. "I shall try to carry you," I said. "We must go back to the sarfug, and there we will think over the matter." In spite of my goodwill and strenuous efforts I was soon compelled to realize that I lacked the strength necessary to carry my adopted son across deep snow, with stones and pits hidden under it, which made me stumble frequently. Yongdan, who had reluctantly obeyed my express command to let himself be carried, then endeavored to proceed, leaning on me and on his staff, creeping rather than walking, and stopping every 10 minutes. Drops of perspiration caused by the painful effort fell from the llama cap which covered his forehead. It took us hours to reach the sarfug. I massaged Yongdan's ankle, and bandaged it with his belt. I could do no more. As on the day before, we had no fuel and shivered as we lay on the frozen ground. The snow which we had eaten to quench our thirst on the road, as well as the icy water brought from the stream to drink with our meal, had increased the painful sensation of internal cold that kept us awake. Yet, had it not been for my concern for my young companion, I should have found a peculiar charm in my situation. Indeed, that charm was so powerful that it triumphed over my preoccupations and my physical discomfort. Until late that night I remained seated, motionless, enjoying the delights of my solitude in the absolute silence, the perfect stillness of that strange white land, sunk in rest, in utter peace. And the snow still continued to heap itself around us. In the morning, when I opened my eyes, the first thing I saw was Yongdan standing on one leg, leaning on his staff, with his back against the earthen wall of the Safug. His attitude reminded me of that of certain Chinese spirits in the Tos temples, and he would have been quite comical in any other circumstances, but tears were in his eyes. "I cannot walk," he said in despair. "I have already tried several times, but I cannot stand on my foot." His ankle was swollen, the foot remained twisted out of its normal position. It was impossible to start. We spent the first morning hours in discussion. I thought of leaving my companion with the baggage and the handful of sampa that remained and of trying to reach some village to ask for help, but Yongdan doubted whether anyone would follow me and take trouble for mere beggars, as we appeared to be. As for showing money or offering a reward of some importance, such a thing would prove more dangerous than anything else. Perhaps my son was too pessimistic in his opinion of the pippas, but more serious objections could be raised against my plan. We did not know how far the villages were, and which were the roads that led to them. 2 days ago, when coming down from the Ainila, we had seen three tracks. All traces of these would now be hidden beneath deep snow. The river remained the only guide, and it was not a reliable one. It could not fail to flow down to the inhabited region. But we were not certain that we could follow its course all the way. Mountain streams frequently enter narrow gorges, while travelers' paths cling to the hills far above them, although they both meet again miles away. What if I missed the right path and had to retrace my steps? I might wander several days, meet with an accident as my companion had done, or starve and fail to reach my goal. I could not deny that Yongdan's apprehensions, gloomy as they might appear, were well grounded. As for me, I felt very frightened at the idea of abandoning the lame young man in that cave, where wolves, bears, snow leopards, or other hungry beasts might attack him at night, while he could not even stand on his feet to protect himself. So time passed while we made plans and rejected them, one after another. I eventually decided to follow the valley down as far as I could, in search of docpas. I would return by evening. I walked the whole day, seeing two deserted encampments, but not one living being. I was overcome with sorrow at the thought of the lama who had remained shivering in the Safug. How much better he would have been in one of those abandoned huts, in which fuel left by the docpas could have warmed him. At any rate, I ought to bring some back with me. But how could I carry it? I had no bag nor any piece of cloth with me, and only a thick woolen material could prevent the cow dung from becoming wet on the way. As I had no choice, I took off my upper dress made of coarse Tibetan serge, packed the fuel in it, tied the load with my belt and, having fastened it on my back, I started. It was an exhausting tramp. The snow had not ceased to fall, and my thin Chinese underdress was but an insufficient protection against it. Before half an hour elapsed, I felt as if I were in an icy bath. Night came while I was still far from the cave. I could not miss my way, the stream being there as a guide, but in the darkness I failed to find the exact place of the Safug. Had I proceeded too high up the valley, or was I still below the spot where the cave was situated? I realized that I did not know. I was on the point of shouting to the lama when I discerned a small light a little higher up. No doubt Yongdan was there and he had lighted, to guide me, the roll of taper which we had in our bag. Such, indeed, was the case. I was half dead with fear. He told me, when I joined him, "I fancied the very worst, when evening came and you did not return. The fire, and a bowl of hot tea in which we threw a few pinches of barley flour, cheered us, even though our wretched plight had grown rather worse. Our food supply was now reduced to 3 or 4 spoonfuls of tsampa, and a little tea dust. We were still in ignorance as to the distance that separated us from the villages, and the path that led directly to them, and poor Yongdan was still unable to walk. Not worry about me, Jetsonma, said the llama as I was drying myself near the fire. No, you do not fear death, and I do not fear it, either.